I'll go for an hour, I guess. So in this talk, I'd like to talk about some of the more advanced bits of Mathematica here. I've got probably too much to say to fit into the time, so I'll be touching on various of the topics that I'm going to consider here. So since the school was a little bit more, there was some performance considerations in the school, I'll focus a little bit more on some stuff to do with parallel computation, compilation, linking to external programming, touch on GPU programming, and then I'll move on to some topics in the actual front end, manipulate some front end considerations, the box language, how to introduce notations to make your computations pretty and to be able to transmit information. I'll quickly go through some examples, and if I get time, I'll touch on some aspects, some goodies, machine learning and artificial intelligence extensions in Mathematica. Okay, so I'd like to start off with parallel programming. In Mathematica version 7, we added some parallel processing capabilities, and it's since extended from there on in. And so a lot of it sort of breaks down. Parallel processing breaks down in Mathematica in two different things, the very low level parallelization and the high level, the gross parallelization level. And so on my particular laptop, I have four cores. It's an i7 laptop. And with hyperthreading, the Intel processor in there, it will sort of pretend to be eight cores. And that pretending is sometimes good, sometimes bad, depending on the workload that you give it. And so one of the things, each one of the kernels that I actually have running actually has a process ID. This is just a normal Unix process ID. If I go to my command line here, I get some terminal, psax, and I grep for Mathematica. I'll actually see it has a process ID right there of this 6763, and I can actually see that process ID right there. So I can do this computation, I can evaluate any expression. One of them I can actually evaluate in each of the kernels as this parallel evaluate, and you'll see if I hit this quickly, it'll flash up. I'll see it launches eight kernels, and there's the process ID of all of the various eight kernels. So indeed, we actually have eight processes running now. If I go back and I take a look at my output here, I can see each of the different kernels. And so I've got eight kernels running now, and they're waiting for input that I can actually feed it, and they'll give me back answers. So one typical example that I'll give here is this factorization of an integer into its prime factorizations, and that's something in Mathematica. It uses a generalized sieving algorithm as the sort of state of the art to figure out what is the factorization of an integer, and it depends on sort of the size of the integer. But it's somewhat non-deterministic that you can have one integer right next to another. One will be fast, one will be slow to actually factorize. So this is just an illustration of the parallel tools here. I am going to go and I am going to submit to each one of the into the queue of tasks to actually do. I'm going to say factorize this integer, and I'm going to factorize the ones from 10 to the 54 plus 50 to 10 to the 54 plus 70, and this parallel submit sort of submits it into the queue. And so this is a nice sort of visual way that I can actually see this. I'll just drop down to 100% so you can actually see this. And now, as I go wait all, I'll see this execute on all of the various different kernels, and some will be fast, some will be slow. You can see now we're down to running on one computation on kernel 6, one on kernel 8. This depends on the sort of time. And so in the end, this illustrates one of the properties of parallel processing. It's called Amdahl's law, I think, is that you're limited by the slowest process. And more properly in terms of when you're doing things in parallel by the slowest thing in series. But this particular factorization on one of the kernels was slower than the others, and we had to actually wait for it. And here's the actual answers of all of the various different prime factorizations of the numbers we gave. So let's actually turn around and compare the parallel to non-parallel versions here. Here's this table of factorizing some integers. We're doing it 10 to the 50 plus 3 here to 10 to the 50 plus 20 here, we get some particular answer, and we could do the exact same thing, turning around, and actually we could, instead of table, we're going to use now a parallel table. And so this now, parallel table, right down the end here, will do the exact same computation, but it's now spitting it out to each of the cores. And it went quite to each of the cores, and each of the kernels on the various cores, and we see it went quite fast. We can actually turn around and see, did they actually give the same results? And compare them, and indeed, they will actually, doing it in serial or doing it all in the various cores, gives us the same results. We should now actually turn around and compare the actual absolute timing here. Absolute, this is the wall clock time. of this particular calculation. We'll hide the output so it's a little bit easier to see. And we see here that took 2 seconds. And if we do it in parallel across all the various cores, we are actually getting a bit more. Oh, generally sometimes a little bit faster than that. But we usually get more towards the 4-times speed up. So it's not 8 times with our cores. There's probably some transmission here. And it's limited, as I said, by the actual speed of the slowest computation on the various cores. OK, and so that's parallel table. And we've got other things. Well, so it actually has to, so the Pedro number is a purely iterative thing. And it depends on the previous result. So we can't actually. So the Pedro numbers are purely iterative. And so this is, and so parallel is important here when we can do things in gross parallelization. It's really good if we can give it each core and each kernel a single task. Here's a task, go off by yourself, don't talk to anybody else, work on it, come back and give me the answer. If we have gross. The Pedro number is very fast to compute. We've got a fast algorithm for computing Pedro numbers, so it's not going to actually speed anything up. We purposely did that. But if we put Fibonacci in there, we could put this in. It wouldn't be too hard. You could.
Yep.
So you need to distribute definitions and some of the other things. There's a little bit of work once you actually put functions in here. You have to distribute them to each of the kernels so the kernels actually know about them as well. But again, I'm going really fast, and so I'm giving you a taste of these particular things. You can sort of see the flavor, and then you'll be able to dive in yourself to the. There are certain. It has to. I think there probably is options for parallel table here. If we actually take a look at the help and go in, I haven't actually looked. There will be options here somewhere. Distributed context. I'm sure you can modify it if you actually take a look. I'm very sure. The one thing I wanted to actually mention here with parallelize, just at the end, so here we've actually had to manually come in and put parallel table in, and we've decided which bits are parallel or not. It'd be quite nice if we could actually just have Mathematica do this for us automatically. And in some simple cases, we can actually do that. And so we can just actually wrap parallelize around the particular computation, and it'll actually do all of that distributing automatically for us, and we get down to something reasonably fast. So this is the high level, the gross level parallelism that we would like to just break our task up into various things and do a whole bunch of computation on one kernel and get back a nice simple result and not do lots of talking to. You can do the outer table and not do the inner one. So the inner one's done on the. Sure, you could. At the worst, you make a substitution variable, and then you compute the other one internally if you want. But I think from the other kernels, you can distribute to other kernels as well. But I don't know. We'd have to actually take a look at the defaults and get and start digging really into the package to actually do it. But the point is, it's here. You can distribute over the various kernels. And if you've got things that break up really nicely into parallel tasks, you can do that. So that's the gross level parallelization. I'd actually like to talk about the core parallelization now of just doing normal things and having Mathematica break this up across many cores by itself. And so this is actually a question by Wilke, who might still be here. Does matrix multiplication, does it actually go and distribute across many cores? And actually, if this is the default setting here on the system options, we could actually take a look at the system options here and take a look here at the parallel options, and you can see this is sort of controlling the system options will give you, in fact, let's take that out, give you a whole list of various things. It's reasonably big. We could take a leaf count of that thing. You could actually see, and this controls all of the internal behaviors of many algorithms, and so you can see it's big. If we get first slash at system options. Slash at, you can see there's various things that control all sorts of different aspects. When algorithms switch over from one domain to another, and they're switching. And so, but one of the things we're interested in here is the parallel options here, and we see that by default on my machine here, this the MKL, which is the math kernel library, and so Math Intel makes these the various libraries. So the Intel engineers have hand optimized really tightly to get their last 1 or 2% out of the internal libraries to work on the Intel processors for, you know, multiplication, the BLAS systems, the basic linear algebra systems, LAPACK, and some of the other things that the numerics internally use in Mathematica. And so that those libraries are multi-threaded, and indeed we use them. So we can actually see, and this is an example of used timing here, interestingly. So on this is the default on 4 threads. We can see it takes 6 seconds. And if we actually use timing on using just 1 thread, it actually appears, I should say, to be faster. It's like, wait, it wasn't doing any actual multi-threading at all across the various cores. But it turns out that timing here, it depends on the architecture, is actually giving us the total time across all of the cores. So it takes the time on the first core, second core, third core, adds them all together, and that's sort of the whole process time that it's actually taking. So it's important, this is a trick or something to gotcha, to actually know that we should actually be using the wall clock timing to actually do these computations. And when we use the wall clock timing, we actually get something considerably faster. And so we get something not quite 4 times, maybe 3 times faster when it's actually just doing, by default, its normal numerical operations as it's multi-threading across different cores. OK, so that's a little bit about parallelism. I'd like to now move on to one of the examples that was in the exercises, and I'd like to talk about vectorization. So this, I'm going to work this example of a central moment, and I'm going to do it in various different ways. One, just as a normal sort of sums and products as you might write out by hand, one vectorized, and one using parallel computations and actually sort of compare them. So central moment, basically we've got how many data points? We've got n data points, x1, y1, z1, x1, x2, y2, z2, x3, y3, z3, and so on. And I've got powers that I'm taking those to. Those are the moments. And it's just basically the sum. This is just like a generalized version of a variance across multiple variables. And so given some data, and in fact, let's actually go take a look at some data here. We've got some data here, x1, y1, z1, x2, y2, z2, x, y3, z3, and some moments. I'm going to be taking the first powers of these things. And of course, you've seen by, of course, you're now very familiar with, we could take the part, maybe we take the third data element, we take the first one of that, which should be the x3, and we indeed get x3, take the third, will be z3, take, you know, 4, gives me z4, and so on. So the I and j here are labeling the particular bits of the data. So to actually compute the sum here over the product, I can take data ij minus the means. Of course, the length of n is, we've given this data, it's a list, it's being fed into the function. Give the moments is also a list. And we get n as the length of the data, w is the length of the moments. And so we can apply just simply plus across the data. It's vectorized, divide by n. I can get this data here, and I can just apply plus to it here, plus as before, and it just gives me the sum of all the various things. So I divide by 4, which is the length of the data. That gives me the mean. So it's just simple vectorization here. It gives me the means. And so I can take from each data point, minus it from the mean, take it to its power, and take that product as I normally, you know, write out, and finally take the sum. And that's the definition of the simple central moment revisited. Simple verification. So if I take this particular thing and I take a look at that, I can actually sort of see here we've got, you know, x1 minus the means of the data points. I could change the moments here to make them squared or cubed or so on. And so we have our particular function is working just like the internal one, which we can actually verify. My central moment is actually working like central moments. So nothing too taxing or anything, but we're just looking, we're doing it as we'd normally do it, you know, sums over products, we're entering it in. As we would. So let's actually see if we can actually vectorize that. And so what can we do to vectorize this? So we can actually use inner. So just as a recap of inner, if I have some f and I have some a, b, c, d, and I also have some, you know, x, y, z, w, and I put that like over times, and I've got some a and b are defined here. Why don't I just quit the kernel from before, because a and b are defined, and I'll just re-enter those bits above, like so, and So now I've got this inner across, and so we can actually see, oh, I'll change that to plus just for illustration purposes. And so you can see the pairings, A is paired with B, A is paired with X, B is with Y, C with Z, and D with W, and it's over this particular function F. So if I actually want to raise that to the particular power, if I replace F by power, then I'll get power A to the X power, B to the Y's power, and so on. So if I replace that by power, I get AX to the Y plus BY plus CZ plus D, and I can actually make that times if I want. And then finally, I get this product here. And this is all nicely using sort of the vectorized form of the operations. And so I can define this moment here where I take the actual data point minus its means, raise it to the rth power, and we have our moment acting as we'd like it to. Oh, and I'll zip back to 150% here to actually see that. Okay, so so here's the my central moment. It's almost exactly the same as before. We have our length n, we have our means here, and we're actually now mapping the moment, this moment function, this vectorized moment function, over the particular data points, over the data list here. And so we're using map, and we can actually, again, see, I need to define data, and I need to define that. And we see the vectorized version of the central moment is the same as central moment. And finally, we can actually turn around, and instead of map, instead of this operation here being map, we can make, instead of using map here, we can use parallel map. And we can actually see the difference as we go. So this is exactly the same as before, but now we're using parallel map. Okay. And the parallel map, it'll go across, it launches all the kernels, and of course, it's true. It's the same as before. So let's actually now take a look at some speed comparison here. So we'll take a look, we'll give 10,000 elements, and our data things will have 10 components to it, 10 vectors. We're going to raise it, each component to the fifth power, and actually take a look at the central moment of that using Mathematica's function, and see it's blazingly fast, 0.006 seconds. We'll use the slow version using products and sums, and we'll find out it's quite a bit slower here at 0.3 seconds. And as we work out that, we see, you know, we're maybe two orders of magnitude slower by using the iterative version. If we turn around and use the parallelized version, it's a bit faster, maybe four times faster. Using the vectorized version and the parallel version here, we think, oh, well, great, we're going to get some speed up. It actually turns out we're slower. And we're slower because we're doing 10,000 computations, and each one of those 10,000 computations is being fed out to each one of the kernels, and we get the results back, and so we're actually losing in the communication time rather than actually the processing time of actually working on the speed up. So that gives you some flavor, some touching flavor about parallel and parallelization and some of the things to do with it. I'd actually like to talk about compilation now and compiling to C and actually using C compilation. So here is this function, this is a pure function on two variables here, f. And so if I apply t, w here to this function, it works. It's a normal pure function as you've sort of seen. And the compiled version is almost the same. We've just replaced the head function with compile. So both of those things we can implement and use. And here's this one here where we've gotten this last result here, and we've just added this compilation target to C. Okay, and so this now, as I evaluate it, it'll take a little bit of time. You can see that bracket flash for a bit. What it's actually done is it's gone and it's created a dynamically linked library, and it's linked that into Mathematica so I can actually use. So it's interesting now to actually take a look at the full form of the CF, this compiled function. Right above here, I've called this here, the CF is the compiled version, and we can actually see the full form of this is actually this. Might look like gobbledygook, but this is instructions in the state machine, the Wolfram virtual machine that's running that Mathematica uses to put it's compiled on. You can think it's like the JVM in Java or something else like that. It's its own version of the state machine. And now, if I take a look at the compiled one, the C compiled one, it has the same function, but it's got this extra bit. And it says here it's a library function here, and here's the various path to it here, and right there, compiled function of 0. And so this is now a dynamically linked library into Mathematica. It's a real C function, and we can call it like so. So here, let's actually take a look at some timings of our version, or just the standard Mathematica one, and the C version, the compiled version, and the C version. So we see there's not that much difference from the Mathematica compiled one to the actual C version. So, and this isn't too surprising. It's a relatively simple function, square root of x, comma y. There's a lot of communication overhead. Nothing's really happening. We're not doing a lot, just in a tight inner loop on C. So let's take a look at an example that's just a bit more complicated than that, where C should actually really shine. And this is here where we're getting the C compiled version here. And into compile, we're actually passing in the type. X is a real, N is an integer. We've got a module that goes around. We start off with an increment of 1, but it's really this inner loop here that where things are going on. And what's going on here is we take at every step, we're going to be incrementing, we're going to be multiplying this increment by this factor, and then we're going to be summing it. So this is a very tight inner loop. C should do very well here because it can compile it up to really tight machine instructions and actually do this computation. So here we see this compile version with the target being C. Here we see the exact same version with compile without the compilation target being C, and this is being done on the Wolfram virtual machine, and this is just the normal Mathematica version of the function, and we can actually take a look now and see the speedups. So here, the C version is very fast. The Wolfram virtual machine here is maybe an order of magnitude slower, and the iterative, purely dumb, interpreted, go around. Mathematica is doing all the interpretation, checking each and every time for all sorts of boundary conditions and everything else is quite a bit slower here. And so this is almost like three orders of magnitude slower when we compare them. So you can, at certain circumstances, get a huge difference if you don't do a lot of the automatic checking that Mathematica does on its various arguments. Of course, I should point out the limitations in the C version here. Of course, it's only working at machine precision. We've got those kinds of problems. There's other issues as well. But indeed, we can actually work with something called symbolic C. So if you need to actually work with C code, you can generate symbolic C code in Mathematica and link it in, compile it, and actually run it as sort of native code in Mathematica, and it's very fast. Okay, so then I'd actually like to talk about linking through to external C code through MathLink. And so you can actually link Mathematica up to, your external C programs, and you can in fact have your C programs call back into Mathematica, have your Mathematica call into C programs back and forth, and do all sorts of interactions there. And so here's, I've set it up on my machine here. There's a little bit of setup that you need to worry about to put it in, but maybe 5 minutes work, 10 minutes work, get the right include libraries. Always when setting up C, there's a bit of some kerfuffle there in setting it up. And so here, if we actually go take a look on my directory here, there's MathLink example here. We can actually see a couple files, this add2.c and add2.tm, which implement this particular function. And so add2.c is pretty simple. It takes an int I and an int j, and it returns the sum of those two particular things, which is an int, and it's called add2. And we need to make sure that there's a way to generate these templates and so on. But add2 takes an integer I and an integer j, and it just gives the sum of the two machine integers. There's the usage string, and so on. And so what we do is we go here to the actual this version, and we use C command. Here I'll make this a bit bigger, and we turn around and make add2 here, and it will say add2 is up to date. So fine, we can go back to Mathematica and run this example. We can take a look at add2, and we see it comes out, and it says it's going to add two integers. It gives the sum of two machine integers, x and y, and it has this link object here, which we're now linking, and it calls a call packet out to the external function, and now we can actually use it. Add2 of 30 and 10 should give us 40, as we'd expect. So just to show that I'm not faking this and everything, I'll go back here. I'll change this to I times j, for instance, and compile that up, make it, and it'll compile it, go back to Mathematica, and run it again. And now this add 2 should give me 30 times 10, should give me 300. And exactly, I could come here and add 34 to it if I wanted. Plus 34, say, go here, back, compile, run, and the normal repeat, compile, run loops as per standard. And we see that it gives us the same answer, 150 plus 34 is there. And we could just change it back now, of course, to something that makes sense for the name. OK, so that's how we can compile that gives you a taste of compiling. There's various ways to transport integers and strings and lists of lists of numbers, lists of real floats, and so on, back and forth to C, back to Mathematica, so you can do this transmission to your C programs. And of course, the point of this is that you can link up other external libraries in C++ that are being hand-optimized by some other people or something else and put them into Mathematica. And indeed, link Mathematica to Java and databases and all sorts of other linking. Well, it depends on what Mathematica does, and it depends on the actual function it's compiling down to. So, it'll probably be faster in Mathematica because it doesn't actually have to do the calling down to something else. But compile of a comma b. We're gonna probably have loop overhead optimization here that goes in. I would imagine compile. Of that, of 30 comma 10 gives us 40, and we want to actually turn around and go some. You wanted some. Some do of that. Yep. Right, there's a lot of link overhead. Good question. Right. Absolutely. You can link up to many, many different things. You need this protocol. The worst case scenario is you link through to C and then C links through to something else if you needed to. Especially if your wrappers are thin, you can do that. But we have Java. I think we've got Fortran, we've got various versions of Python. It's a matter of actually, because there's something called the Wolfram WSTP, the Wolfram Symbolic Transport Protocol. It used to be called MathLink, and it got rechristened and upgraded. And so you have this, you can sort of send an integer, send reals, lists of reals, lists of things. And so once you do that and you define on your other end, the Fortran end, something to receive those, then you've established this communication. You know, all you need is strings, symbols, numbers and talking back and forth, and once you've got that, you've got your communication, and then you do it. So I'm sure there's stuff for Fortran as well. Sorry, a question? No, the one in here is MinGWC, I think, is the actual compiler that you're actually using. But you saw when I compiled it right there, I was using GCC. But the actual one that we use through Symbolic C is actually MinWGC, I think, is the one we actually use. So I think it's either included or maybe we use GCC, but I think that's on Windows, so I'm not too sure on the Mac. It might go down to GCC on the Mac, but I think it used MinWGC. Absolutely. So there's this thing. I mean, it's not the right way to do it, of course, because in C you've got nice IDEs that do all the rest of it. But if you actually take a look at Symbolic C here, this is a symbolic representation of C, and you can actually say to like code string, and you can actually take, here's a C program with includes and a C function, int valuable, doing various things, and this will actually, I guess here we compile it up. We'll take this, and it'll actually. Besides the syntax highlighting, it'll actually take that to a C program, and that will go off and get compiled. So you can actually have a representation, just like in XML, you might have seen Symbolic XML, and in Symbolic C, you have a representation of a C program, you know, the C functions and includes and definitions and everything, so you can actually write a C program in Symbolic representation in Mathematica, and then spit it out, and then compile it. Okay, so, right, so I wanted to briefly talk about the performance of sparse arrays. They've been mentioned, Pedro's mentioned them, and Vilke and some of the others here. And so one thing that you might have seen is the sparse arrays, this is how they're generated. And here we have a sparse array, the diagonal is 1, so the ith element is 1, and the off-diagonal elements 2 and 4, and 4 and 2 are both 1 here. And we can actually take a look at the matrix form of that, and indeed you can see they're off-diagonal forms. So you might think you have to actually enter sparse arrays in this particular form. But you don't. I can actually get the normal form of array here, and that's just a normal Mathematica list, and I could actually turn around and ask for what's the sparse array for that, and I'd get down to a sparse array, and I could actually take the full form of, you know, 56, percentage 56, and I could take the full form of my percentage 53, and I could actually see full form percentage 53 here. And so that's my first one, that's my second one. I'll delete that one in the middle, and you actually see, well, that's handy, isn't it? Great. Right, sparse arrays. Where were we? Sparse arrays. So they had the same full forms. Okay. So one of the things I want. It's what, sorry? It's probably my Mac? No, I don't know. So this machine, I don't know if you can hear it. It's got a death rattle. Can you hear the death rattle? I something going wrong with this. I've actually got a new machine. And so it might be to do with that. It might be to do with just other versions. We are coming out. Okay, so sparse array here. This is a version of a sparse array. This is just tri-diagonal with the various elements are random here. And I'm just going to use this to take a look at some performance characteristics of sparse arrays. And here we have a matrix plot. You can see for this particular thing, it's sparse down the diagonal here. Okay, and so sparse arrays are much faster when working with them. Here we have this 1,000 element tri-diagonal system. The timing is very fast. If we have the one where we've taken this exact same matrix and we make it dense and we do it, we're getting maybe, you know, two orders of magnitude faster by doing sparse computations when the matrices underneath are indeed actually truly sparse. If the matrices underneath are not sparse, and we're actually doing dense multiplication like this, so here we have an array of random numbers, 1,000 by 1,000. We take a look and we get some timing for their multiplication. If we treat that as a sparse array, because of course sparse array is just a record of all the various entries that are in terms of their values, it's not the right form, it's not packed, it doesn't do other sorts of things, then it can be quite a bit slower. And so that's probably, you know, 25 times slower to do it in a sparse way. So sparsity and using sparse matrices are very good when things are actually sparse. If they're not sparse, you can get, instead of a two order of magnitude speed up, you can actually maybe get an order of magnitude slowing down by using it. So use sparse matrices judiciously, and they're very useful when you can actually use them. Okay, so I'd like to talk a little bit about briefly touch now on GPU programming, as Vilke mentioned. The main system these days for GPU computations, the one that's very popular, is CUDA Link. And so if I load up the CUDA Link package, and I actually see, does my laptop do CUDA? No, it doesn't. So my graphics card on this laptop, with its death rattle, is not good enough to actually run CUDA, so I can't demonstrate any of the GPU sorts of computations on this laptop. However, I can demonstrate some of the things in OpenCL Link, which is one of the competing standards. So, and it hasn't done quite so well. One of the advantages of OpenCL is that you can sort of formulate these programs in this C-like language, and you can do them both, hopefully, on your graphics card and on your main GPU. And so, as Vilke said, the graphics cards these days, they've gone from strength to strength. They do, you know, double precision arithmetic, but they are SIMD generally. So that's single instruction, multiple data, sort of computations where they're highly parallel in their data. You load them up and you do this one instruction on many of its streaming units, or cores as you call them, maybe 1,000, maybe 2,000 cores at the same time. So if you can structure your problem in the right way, you can get these very vast speedups. Of course, by Amdahl's law, you're still limited by which bits are serial, you're still limited by how much the memory on the card is, translating back and forth, getting stuff in. So getting your factors of thousands of speedups is tantalizingly close, but often it's not quite so achievable. But you can still get very appreciable speedups. So we can actually turn around and see, does my laptop do? Oops, I'll just quit that there. Does it do CUDA Link? And indeed, happily, my laptop does CUDA Link here. And so here's some source code for a particular program. It's sort of C-like here. And it's going to be taking a list of machine integers. Here we have this global machine integers. This is global 0. And we have another list of machine integers, global 1. We're given a machine integer width, the height. And here's some indices. And so the way GPU computations are sort of work, they're structured into blocks. And so we're going to be getting the sort of x coordinate of the, in the block and the y coordinate in the block that we're doing at the same time, depending on the architectures and stuff. And so we get an x index, a y index, and we finally get that index here. And if we're still within the bounds of, because we don't want to write outside our memory block, we can set the particular, some of the values in this global list that we've actually passed in. So there's the source code. It's done as a text file. And again, there's other development tools outside that you can use for developing GPU sort of calculations here. But here we give the signature, lists, two lists of integers we're passing in, the width and the height here. We give it the block dimensions here. And now we can do some sort of calculation. This just gives you a taste. So here we have width and height of 64, passing in these constant arrays of zero. And actually now we can do this particular calculation and turn around and visualize the results. So let's actually go back and change something here on this left-hand side. Instead of actually just getting simply the setting the x value, the x coordinate by the local ID plus that, we can actually change it and put in, say, the local ID 1 here, change the source program, do the calculation, do it again, and we can see we can actually change the actual output. So, of course, it's a bit of a moving target because the graphics cards are constantly changing, the operating system's constantly changing, the actual program, the OpenCL versions are kind of constantly changing, and there's other bits that are changing at the same time, includes different platform stuff. But if you can get around the pain of some of the stuff and setting it up, you can really get a lot of, and if your problem is adaptable to this low-level sort of parallelization where you don't need like the Pedro numbers to refer to previous results and some of these other things, you can actually just do the same operation many times. And they're sort of independent of some of the others or nearest neighbor sorts of things, you can get quite high speed ups. Okay, so that's a little bit about performance and optimization. I'd actually like to now talk a little bit more about some of the underlying bits of the front end. I haven't actually talked about that too much at all. So I wanted to mention here style sheets. They're useful when you drive Mathematica. They're very useful, and you should know about them. And so if I have some particular notebook here, I've got some title, I've got some chapter 1 here, for instance, and I've got some other chapters here, 2 and 3, say, for instance, and I've got some text in here, lorem ipsum something, some text here, and in my various chapters as I would have it. Okay, so here's a notebook as I'd normally sort of use it, and let's say I always want my chapters here, my chapter titles to be in a certain style. Well, normally I'd go in here and I'd go and I'd change and I'd choose something depending on my own personal style, let's just choose something very garish and horrible like Marker Felt. Whew, that's pretty ugly. And so we would choose some sort of title like that, and I could go through each particular chapter title and change it. But instead, the better way to do that is, of course, to actually edit the style sheet, and I can actually turn around and choose the chapter style here and actually now change it uniformly to something else. I can go in, and if I make some change to the chapter style here, I'll use something modern, Optima. There we go. So all of the other chapters appear quite nice, and so I have changed it now uniformly throughout my notebook apart from this particular style, and I could just delete that and create it again, or I could turn around and change the underlying boxes, which I'll actually talk about. So that works fine for chapter styles. I could maybe change the text style as well, get that, make it italic, and you see it's all turned italic there, and change the text color, for instance, to brown, and decide to design my styles as I'd like to. So you should make all of your modifications to the actual style sheets instead of the actual notebooks, and it'll all flow through in a nice uniform way, and everybody will be happy. But why I want to actually talk about as well style sheets is that they define not only the visual styles, they define some other computational things indeed inside here. So if I go to the actual core style sheets in Mathematica, I will see right down the bottom here's this template box styles, and this defines the presentation in terms of your notations of various things that we're about to actually look at and I'm about to talk about now. So. Excellent. Sure. Okay. The artificial stuff. So I'll mention, did you mention notations stuff? A little bit. So so Collier has actually mentioned some of the boxes. I'll talk about that in a second. No one's actually. Okay. I'll do it quickly. I'll skip some of the bits. I'll just do the actual usage of the notations from the boxes. So I wanted to briefly talk about the manipulate. I should have probably mentioned it before. I'll say, since a lot of you are physicists, you might actually go off and sell your souls later on and not go into finance, not go into physics. You might go off into finance. And so let's start off with something very simple: the compounding interest, of course, of some amount of money. And so here's an example. So if we have some money A, $300, and it compounds at interest rate R over time t, it goes up exponentially. And so very simple. You all know this kind of stuff. And you go, wow, that's pretty simple. Does it get more complicated than that? And then finance, indeed it does. But let's say we've got a global financial crisis and our interest rates actually fall to 4%, 5% there, something. We can see a different curve there. And you say, well, in my 401k, it's going to get a bit small there, so I better put in an amount of $400 there and say, oof, that's not so great. And so I could turn around and say, well, U.S. Treasuries are actually only getting 2%. What does that look like? That's there. And so that's what I'd normally play around with certain amounts and certain other parameters. And so that's what you'd normally do, and you enter in some parameters and take a look at some results. And once you do that, that's a perfect example now to actually turn around and manipulate that. So you turn around, and we're going to actually manipulate two of these variables here. We want to manipulate the interest rate here. We'll go from 1 to some Visa-crushing 25%, for instance, and the amount A, the starting off, will go from 0 to, let's say, 500. And so here we can actually get the output. And now as I move these particular sliders, I can sort of see the output here. And so, you know, I can start off with an amount of $300 interest and take up the interest rates, and I can actually sort of see them move. So that's a very simple example. I can start out, and I can actually say what's the starting value for the R here, and we'll start out with a healthy, nice, diversified portfolio amount of maybe 7%, and maybe you're starting out with, what's that? Not everyone so you start off with something else like that, and you can see these parameters now have started off at different sorts of values, so you can specify them. So let's actually go back and take a look at one of the examples we've done here in terms of sparse arrays, and we have some sparse array calculation here, and we do some nesting of products here. And let's take a look at the visualization of this as we would in manipulate, maybe. So this is like for some spectral methods or something, and we want to see the effects of how this actually goes. So here we could actually take a look at this particular nesting at level, you know, 2, and we see it's tridiagonal, and we could take a look at it here, it's 4, and we can sort of see the effects of this going. So let's take a look at one matrix in particular, call it S, and then actually turn around and take a look at this S and see how it evolves over some less nesting of level up to n, and turn around and manipulate this here, and we're going to see what we do from n goes from, you know, 0 to, or 1 to maybe 50. And we want to do it in steps of 1, so our dot product actually makes sense. And now we can take a look and we can actually see what's the evolution of our matrix. And so we can actually see the expansion over time as we do it up to higher orders of our matrix and how it expands out. And we can see sort of this hot spot here, and it might have some sort of effects. And so we can play around, and you can use this to visualize different sorts of things quite nicely. So here's another, in terms of Pedro has said about the time that I put in too many fancy sort of examples sometimes. But I just like this example. It sort of gives a little bit of here, I'll just do it quickly here. We have a manipulate of taking a look at the branch cuts of some arcsine imaginary part of this particular example here. And we can, you know, it looks nice, and we can actually take a look at that structure and take a look at the evolution of the branch cuts as we move it. And actually in here, there's some things I'll just mention. We actually change the plot points to be control active. So when the controls are moving, we actually drop down to 5 plot points, and otherwise we have an automatic, and our performance goal here is quality. And so we can actually get things that manipulate reasonably well. And so this is doing a lot of work here, and it gives nice, fancy, pretty sort of graphics. Okay, so I'd mention as well the demonstrations. Just briefly mention demonstrations project. And so this is a project online where we have lots and lots of different demonstrations here. I could mention like black for black holes or something else like that. And you'll see various, you know, there'll be various, what's that? You mentioned it? Cool. Okay, and so you can actually see the various why did you mention it? I thought you hated it. No, so you can see lots of different demonstrations here. And of course, the objective of this is to actually give things that communicate information. And so this would be like, you know, for some first year Riemannian integration, and you know, you can explain this very well as you sort of see, you know, Riemannian integration is all about sort of slicing up the thing. There's the midpoint approximation. You could have the left point approximation, the right point approximation, and so on. And as you increase it, the two integrals converge. And so this communicates very well what the concept of Riemannian sums are. Some student can look at that and go, wow, they get it. And so the demonstrations, and of course these can be quite complicated here. Here's an example I've used before. Of you know, geometric ray optics, and you can move the various things around, move the various bits, and change some various angles, and just, you know, experiment with what's going on. So you can have various demonstrations that are quite complicated. Right. So I wanted to just briefly talk about everything being a box. Collier's talked about make boxes here, so he will have mentioned here that if I take a look at some input like that, you'll actually see that this the x cubed plus 2 is actually indeed, it's represented underneath by this superscript box of x to the 3, plus 2 here for this row box. And so we have this box structures are what lies underneath. If I have this more complicated integral here, we have this, it has a sort of structure. We set sub superscript box for the integral here, and it's got, you know, the exponential e and the differential d and so on. And so we can actually see this as we actually type. I'm using dynamic, which I probably won't have too much time to actually talk about here. But as I actually type something, we can see what actually is being done underneath. And we can see as I type this, it goes into some particular structure. And here we can already automatically see that the row box, the B and the C, is being grouped together apart from the A. And if I change, you know, the precedence here of that, we see a different sort of grouping structure. So this is sort of what's going on underneath. And it's even nicer, probably, to actually take a look at this in tree form. And so it's maybe a bit big. So I'll drop down to 100% here, just to show you the example. As I actually type this particular example here, integral of, you know, exponential e here, you can sort of see it down there, to the minus x squared dx. And so we get some particular form of that thing. I could take it over a fraction, and you see that the head is actually row box now. As I put it over a fraction, it's now fraction box, you know, x plus a, and I put something else over there. So this underlying form of the boxes is actually how Mathematica, the whole front end, actually works. And interestingly, I can actually tell you I am in charge of the boxes at Mathematica. So I work with a very strong team of people, but this language, the actual internal representation and the architecture of how all of these things works internally is what I'm actually responsible for and what takes up some 150,000 lines of code or more of C++ that I work on. And so you might say, well, that's good for typesetting, but what about graphics and so on? You can actually see graphics themselves. We'll go back to a bit higher. So Collier's probably actually talked about this already, but here graphics are indeed a graphics box and a line box, and we get point boxes. And so if we have something like a Bezier curve, you think, well, is that a box? Well, indeed, actually, it turns out to be a Bezier curve box. And so if we have styles, you know, we get some 3 to some font style, it actually turns out to be a style box, a button that we actually can click on, type, you know, hello, and so on. We can actually see that internally that's actually a button box. And same with the slider here. We give an example. These are linked here. This is slider of dynamic of m of n, and it's going from 1 to 100. Here's the actual output, this dynamic of factor, and as I move the slider, we get a different factorization of this particular, of the y to that certain power. But it turns out, indeed, that underneath, the slider is actually a slider box there, and a dynamic is, in fact, a dynamic box. So it turns out it's all about boxes. Everything that the front end actually represents is all about boxes. And so it's very important, then, to be able to actually manipulate these boxes and actually transform and have them have representations of these, you know, input and output in the way we'd actually like to work with. And so so Collier's talked about make boxes and make expressions, so I'll just use the application of this. So we're doing some physics here, and I'm going to start skipping a little bit here. So let's say I want some up operator here, up of A, to be represented like a spin. And so I can actually get here, there's, you know, I can enter it down arrow, I can enter it up arrow here, up arrow. But Mathematica has no interpretation. If I hit shift return, I see this error right here on this right-hand side. It has no conception of what this actually means. It doesn't know how to make a superscript box of A with respect to some up arrow into something. And I'd like it to be up of A. So what I can do is I can enter a notation either off the palette here, or I can enter it via escape notation escape, and I get this right box structure right here, and I can actually see it's a template box here with this notation template tag, and so I can enter these things into the right bits of this notation. I'll tab in. Put an underscore on this side so that it knows it's a variable. So this on this side is the boxes that I want and this is how I want them to actually represent it inside in the kernel. And so now I can actually get this up of A, and it will be evaluated to the same. It looks like it just handled it, but it actually turns out that internally it transformed that to up of A. And so here we've created a notation for this set of boxes, for the boxes superscript of A with respect to some up arrow. So now we could do the same one for down, put in a down arrow here, and change this to down. And as before, I could type in some sort of center dot of, you know, down of, you know, B, center dot, you know, down of C. And I can select that cell bracket, and as I talked about in the previous lectures, the cell convert to standard form. This canonicalize operation now, I can now use this, and I can canonicalize it, and now it operates just like I would want %/full form. It's now parsing and formatting as spins. And so I can now work with them. And so now I can work with this visual form instead of the actual form up and down. And this, of course, hopefully means a little bit more to some physicists or some people than the actual fully explicit forms of ups and downs. So one of the applications of this I'd like to just go to, I'll zip to one of my previous lectures here, is for the MyD. If I go to this and I take a look at this version of differentiation that Pedro loves, we'll turn around and grab the steps for implementing our own differentiation. So here we go. This was our own implementation of the differentiation. Hide that, go here, and paste in. I didn't copy it. Sorry. Copy. And get that, paste it in. And so here we have some versions of the derivative here, and I'd like a notation here. Instead of this df of x, I'd like to make it a little bit nicer here, so I'll just enter in a notation. And I'll put in here, let's make it script d. Script d sub x underscore of some argument f, and that's going to be here our gothic d of f underscore comma x underscore, like that. So now we've created a notation for these things, and so I can get, just as before, I can go cell, convert to standard form, and now it'll convert all of these inputs here to our nice notation. Command shift n, and what's that, sorry? So here we've created this, we've gone from this one form to a sort of nice form. And so here we can see the linearity a little bit better. Our derivative operator here of f plus g is distributing over addition, and we have the product rule here. And of course, we can then grab the other rules here as we've got, hit Command Shift N, and now we've got some nicely formatted rules using our new notations. And of course, we can evaluate the stuff using our new notations. Looks good. Here's the Mathematica version, and here's if we wanted to do our own version, just to see that it actually works. We could go here, go to the end, and see that we're getting the same results through our operator and the Mathematica operator by introducing this particular notation. Okay, so Collier's talked a little bit about make boxes and make expressions. So you can write these rules yourself. What the notation package is actually doing is writing these rules for you. So I'll skip over that. It's interesting to go through that, take a look at the various, it's very illuminating to what's actually sort of going on. And I'll now just skip over to template boxes. So template boxes are the new way we actually do typesetting in Mathematica. We started in Mathematica 7, and now almost everywhere I introduce them in 7. And me and the rest of the team, of course, and in fact, mostly the rest of the team, have then put those on through the rest of the traditional form typesetting, and now all uses template boxes. So if I'd actually typed in my, you know, Legendre P of n comma x and look at that in traditional form, I'll actually see it has a template box underneath. And as we move over it, we can see the Legendre P. And I can't change the P and the, I can change the n and the x only, but I can't select the brackets and some of the other bits. So they've got some nice sort of properties. So let's actually take a look at them in a bit more detail here. And this raw boxes just enters this particular structure onto the in the output, and so I can see that this output here is just template box AB, and it's got this tag binomial. Okay, and so we can do the same here for Legendre P, and so it's formatted like that. Oh, by the way, I've just started using it. I think Collier might have mentioned, I forgot the one big trick here that you have to actually know is cell show expression. I've used this Command Shift D thing, I've just sort of talked about it, but that's how I get back and forth between the actual box expression and the output expression here. So So here we have the form of the template box here for Legendre P, and we see it's almost exactly the same except for this binomial bit. And in fact, if I evaluate this, it's again the same. So this thing formats as a Bessel J, that formats as a binomial, that formats as a Legendre polynomial, but the only thing in the actual box structure that's different is this particular tag. In fact, I could get this tag here and put it in there, and it's now interpreted as a Bessel J. You know, I can change the various bits. I go back here and I change this to a binomial, and it's now a binomial. It's like, wow. So this template box is, in fact, a template. It has two arguments, and this template tells it not only how to visually appear, in fact, it tells it what's its interpretation. So the template boxes are quite powerful. And in fact, they're now, as I've talked about from the style sheet, I can actually go to the style sheet and actually see why does our binomials actually look like that. I can go here to the core style sheet, I go to the template box styles here, I go to the factorial functions, and the binomials is in the class of factorial functions. I can copy the binomial here, and I can close that, go back here. And this is my local definition of a binomial, and I can actually see if I blow this up just a little bit, maybe to 150%, I can actually see that the function here is now a pure function. You can sort of see it operating, and it's creating a row box with this grid box with these two arguments. So we could actually go in here and change it. One of the forms we have for the binomial is, you know, see things, take an m at a time, if I've got that round the right way. So it's basically a superscript box of the particular arguments. So I could go into my binomial here, I could change the actual structure and make this just this particular pure function, go in and change it, and have the first argument here, and the display function, have this as the second argument here, and now I've changed all of my binomials throughout the actual notebook. I type in binomial here, binomial of, you know, q comma t, and take a look at that traditional form, and come in and replace that, and look at all the various bits, and all of my notations throughout the notebook are all now, all of my template boxes are changed because I've uniformly changed the style, and inside here, it's how the display function is actually defined. So I've changed how the display function for this template box is actually defined, and it's now changed this template box uniformly throughout the rest of my notebook. I'm going very fast here, skipping some details, but hopefully this gives you sort of a taste of what these template boxes are and how to actually sort of use them. So let's actually, now that we're physicists, let's actually go and talk about, say, commutators here. We don't need to have these display functions on the actual style sheet as well. I can have them right here. I can enter in particular things here, q, and I get these full forms. And so I actually have on my style sheet here, I actually have a style for a commutator right here, and it's got a particular display function here. It uses a minus sign as for its anti-commutator. And so I can actually take a look at our commutator here in our boxes, and I could turn around and make a notation for this. And so we want this to be the notation for the commutator. So this is actually here. It's using this template box, AB, with this commutator with this particular style. So I can copy that in here, go here, put in a couple variables, and call this my commutator if I wanted of A underscore comma B underscore. And now I've got a notation for my commutators. So full form will in fact be a my commutator, and I can, you know, go in here and I've got Q. And so I've got a full version of my commutators. I can go in and I can No, definitely not. And in fact, because it's here if you're doing that, so So what you do is you're basically creating a template box. So the thing that you're actually pasting in here is a template box. So it's important you paste the right boxes. And so that commutator here has to be defined on the actual style sheet, that form of it. You can do it for certain things that are attached, like you saw those subscripts and superscripts. Some of the things it's quite hard to actually attach to. So like some of the people sometimes want to actually define a notation on that. And the head of that, of course, is row box, and it's possibly a bit too general, and there's some matching arguments, and there's some trickiness here that I'm definitely going to skip over. But if you just stick to yourself, if you restrict yourself for a template box, which is quite easy, and all you need to do for the template boxes is have a display function for the template box, some sort of pure function, you can define sort of whatever you want. And in fact, that's the way we do almost exclusively now, all of our traditional form typesetting is now all done through template boxes. The advantages are just massive. And so we've now moved completely to those. And so now you can very easily define your notations here. And so you just need to make sure in your notation when you actually type this in, and you type that in, that you're actually pasting in your particular template box. And so you actually see that notation itself has a template box holder, but you need to actually get this pasted in into the right places, and you can actually sort of see there's the template box of the template box of the commutator. This could be, you know, binomial if I wanted. So I'm defining some form of binomial to be, you know, my binomial, my bin or something of, you know, A underscore comma B underscore. And so, you know, B and Q. Sorry, B and Q. And B and Q over here. That's another interesting thing. You need the notations, you need the underscores on both sides. And so now my bin of, you know, W comma R will actually, R's got a value. Interest rate, a low interest rate for treasuries, and so it will now parse and you know format is my bin. Cool. Okay. So notation will actually create these make boxes and make expression rules. That's its sort of job. Let's actually do some sort of computations with them here. We can actually see, you know, we're adding some particular commutators here, some things, and it has the right full form. They're operating the way we want here. And we could turn around and actually make some simple sort of rules here. So A to some power integer n, B, if n is greater than 0, then we can drop the power. If they're not ordered, we can, you know, anti-commutate them here. And we can then do some sort of simple, you know, my commutator of, you know, B comma A cubed, something else like that. Put a normal form in, it'll drop that. I forgot to enter that rule, and so on. So we can do some simple calculations now on our commutators. We could have a commutator expand here, for instance. We define some rule and start to do some sort of calculations. Okay, so now let me just briefly mention, so I'm coming up to the hour. I might go an hour and 10 minutes, and I'll show some AI stuff at the end of it. So with tantalizingly dangle the carrot of some of the machine learning stuff. I'd like to talk about some annihilation creation operators here in the algebra. This is one of the exercises, and so So one of the things here, I'll just quit the kernel. I've defined lots of stuff. Sure, I'm going to go very fast, about a minute. So here you can actually sort of see we've got some creation annihilation operator here. We're actually using some flattening, hand flattening. Instead of using attributes for a distinction here. And so like some of the other things you've sort of seen before, you've got some stuff on the left, some stuff on the right. You've got a constants factor out. We factor out over linearity, and we can factor out constants and so on. And so we can actually do that. And then finally, we can add some what's a constant. Again, this is using a nice sort of functional style. If we've got an arguments of times, we can apply the list to it. And to that, we can apply constant q to each of the particular arguments here through a map, and we can see that each and every single one of the factors is constant. The same with the plus, the constant, something to a power is constant, a number is constant, and so on. And now we can actually do some sort of normal ordering calculation, specify it. And so we have, if we've got two annihilation operators, we'll anti-commute if they're unordered. Two creation operators, we'll anti-commute here, the I and the j here, we'll anti-commute if they're not ordered, and an I and a J, creation annihilation operator, will commute with this particular commutation relation. And we're using a bubble sort of algorithm, so it's not particularly advanced, but it suffices. And now we can actually do the particular outputs, and we can do those particular kinds of calculations. So that's nice. And the one thing I did want to actually point out now is I'm just going to skip right to the end and actually just skip to the calculations, is here are some angular momentum calculations which we can actually do. So I've set up some notation, some rules, and of course, I don't actually need to explain to any of the people here what this actually means. We've got two raising operators here operating on this eigenket here, this ket here, which has got an eigenlabels on the j operator, this projection operator here, jz, and of course, we're raising it twice on the for state. I could, you know, raise a k state here and, you know, change that to 6 and so on, change the various parameters, and so I can actually work with these particular notations, and you can recognize them all. So that it's very important we can actually do these kinds of things. And in fact, here's the angular momentum squared, and we can actually see it. We can do this computation on the JMJ state here, do a simplification of it, and see indeed it has eigenvalue J1 plus JH bar squared. So it's quite important that, and I'm getting to the result first rather than last, and so we can, you know, do matrix elements and do these kinds of things, and it's much, much easier to actually read that than reading some sort of whole form eigenlabel. I mean, we can use a sort of textual form that's a little bit simpler, but if you're writing some package to try and make it and give it to other physicists, it's very important you can actually give it to them in something they can actually read. If you have some, you know, m blob sort of function operating on sort of my eig state ket blah something else, it's very hard for them to actually read that, and so they have they have to you know overcome all of that notational stuff. And in fact, that's why physicists have notation, so they can actually communicate. So being able to do your calculations in this, I urge all of you to actually choose good notations. And a lot of the setup is the same as before. I'll just mention here that the rules, once I've actually got these notations set up, I can actually see the JZ, the projection operator here, actually can project out this, you know, the eigenvalue of the Z angular momentum here, the spin, and the raising will raise it, J M raises it to M plus one, lowers it, and so on. And, you know, we can change these particular values here if we wanted and, you know, put in a K or whatever, as I did. Okay, so that's some angular momentum stuff. I should actually mention as well, I haven't mentioned this at all, associations is a new feature in Mathematica, Mathematica 10, I guess. We didn't have it in 9 and beyond. You know, these act like sort of rules, and you might think of these as sort of rule sets, except they're kind of neat in the sense that, you know, I have A slash dot, the various things. I can get that particular value, and I can take a key here, and I can use that as a part, and I can take A, will give me the B key, or C has keys and values and maps and all sorts of things. We'll work over this. These turn out to be immutable arrays and structures, and so a lot of mutable hash mapped arrays, and a lot of the functional language now they're coming into vogue. And here's our version of them. They're fast and efficient at times. What's that? So it's an association. So look it up. I'm going kind of fast. This have you not seen this at all? Any of the various bits? Okay. So this is an association. So it's like a rule set. Only it's sort of an association. So it can only have, what's that? So this associates the key A with the value B and the key C with the value R. So what's the difference between this and a rule set? I think we can actually take normal of a particular rule set will actually take us to a set of rules. But this is actually more efficient for a lot of underlying sorts of operations. And so the rule sets, of course, we can have repeated rules here. So I can have A and B. Substitutions, distributed rules, if you have, when you've got huge rule sets, it'll be faster for associations. I won't go into this too much. So there's a lot in associations. It's now a new sort of data type, and we're actually moving to it uniformly in various places. I will mention, so that it's sort of in vogue now, like in Git and Mercurial, they work off crypto hashes. So when you've got various revisions, you've got, if you know about this, you can actually take, it's one of the things, if we take some expression, we actually get a crypto hash of that particular expression. In the same way, now, with our associations, the way the internals of this actually works, it works off this particular stuff. I think it'll depend on the problem, but yes, I think. So internally, for us at least, for doing these kinds of things, if we want to actually duplicate, if you want to actually modify a set of rules, inserting into the set, we can actually, it's sort of, there's something called search tries and some of the other bits is an algorithm, and so you keep most of the bits immutable, but sort of some of the leaves you actually change, and so it's sort of spine strict, and you just change the stuff on. Databases are quite slow in general, so this is much, much faster than a database, but you could think of it like that, yeah. So, yeah, databases are generally very slow, So it depends on the algorithms of the database, but something like Postgres or MySQL or something, they're heinously slow compared to some of the other algorithms you'd actually use in terms of hash maps and some of the other bits. So it depends on how they factor it and how they work with some of these things. It depends on, you know, whether they're optimized. But in general, some of the database stuff depends on the queries, depends, you know, if they're doing inner joins or something else like that. I'm not a database expert, but anyway. So associations, I'll just mention those. Cloud deploy, there's another thing. We've done all sorts of stuff in the cloud, which I'm just completely glancing over, and some of the other bits. So let me now talk about some bits in machine learning. Okay, so machine learning is a hot topic these days. It's an interesting topic, and in fact, it's getting real-world traction. I think they say there's some 200,000 people working in it now, and people are making money off it. And as over the next 30 years, as sort of we gradually replace humans in various fields of endeavor, they'll all be moving to sort of artificial intelligence to one form or another. They've got self-driving trucks now. I think in Nevada, they're actually driving through now. And of course, within not too long, I'm sure they'll say, oh, well, they're a lot safer, which they are. So they'll replace all the human truck drivers and taxi drivers and so on, and bus drivers, and you know, during the next how many years. So it's a very interesting field. It's kind of scary. As well, in terms of what's society going to do, but I'm not going to. This is going to go live, isn't it? So I better not talk about these kinds of things. But it's a very interesting field of what will hold on the next 30 years. But anyway, so and of course the stuff I'm going to talk about here is some very simple sort of machine learning. There's some of the stuff they do at Google and some of the other places. Andrew Ng, MIT. Now he's off at Facebook or something else. He's gone and joined some of the other bits. They've done some of this deep convolution neural network stuff. Andrew Hinton and others, and they've gotten very, very, very good results with that. And so they've, you know, Google's done interesting stuff. And so one of the things that the machine learning actually sort of breaks down into two sort of distinct spheres. One is supervised learning, and the other is unsupervised learning. And what does this mean? Supervised learning is basically we give you lots of examples and the answers. And so you say, here's, you know, 5,000 examples of things, and here's the answer to the problem at the same time, and then we train something. And that's supervised because it knows the answers. There's unsupervised where it says, I don't even know anything about the answers, it's just here's a whole bunch of stuff, and find something interesting. And actually, Google, the first thing is all things cats on the internet, they managed to recognize in their pictures cats. And so it taught itself to actually recognize cats, and it wasn't told to recognize cats or anything else. It did some unsupervised learning. But here we're going to focus on supervised learning. And so in Mathematica, there's these various example data sets. One of them is machine learning data set. Here is this, that stands for some acronym, some institute, I'm sure, that has collected these things. And I could go get this off the internet. It's about 60 megs. But I have, one of the interesting things here, I'll say as well, is the cell properties here have made it unevaluatable. So you can't, if you try and evaluate this and you listen, you'll hear a beep. Maybe you did, I don't know. But there was a beep there. It wouldn't evaluate. And so what I've done previously is I've gone and I've loaded up all this digit data and I've saved it on my local machine here. And we can see here on my local machine, if I go users, I'm here. And we see there's a logical, the local digit data.mx file. It's 60 megs there. And so here I can actually just quickly load it from dump git. And so now digit data, as you saw, it was blue. Now it's black. And so I could actually, you know, length of digit data, and I see it's a good 70,000 examples of digits. And so let's take a look at 50 samples of these random digits. And so here is it's classified. We're doing supervised learning. And so here's various examples of different digits, and there's the answer that we know we're telling it. So you know this 9 here looks like a 9, 8 looks like an 8, you know 7 and zeros and so on. So what we can do is we can take a random sample of this data and turn around, and we can classify them. And so classification, there's two problems in supervised learning that breaks down roughly into two classification things, or two problems. One is to classify something, so that's given a whole set of data. Can we classify, does this person have, you know, cancer or not? Or what's a blood type? So given some various factors, is this A, is this O, is it AO or A negative or something else? And so you're trying to break something down. And indeed, digit recognition is a classification problem. We're going to give it a sequence of bit, we're give it a bitmap, a raster image, and say, what digit is it? And the other one is prediction. And we've got both in here. So prediction is maybe, let's say you've got house prices. And so you want to say the house price is dependent on how many bedrooms it's got, how many bathrooms it's got, the square footage, which area it's in, is it front-facing, what's the crime in your area, and finally, given that figures in your particular city, how much is your house worth? You know, $350,000 or something. And so that'll give you a prediction instead of a classification into a group. But here we've got some supervised, we've got some samples here. We've trained this thing, we've classified it here, and let's actually give it some digit here and see what it actually does. So we get some digit, and we'll get there, the 8. Paste it in there and classify it. Ooh, we've got a 4. So that's not so good. Let's try it on a 9 here. Oh, I got a 9. Okay. And what about that 3? Is it being able to classify that as a 3? And indeed it can. And so we could, you know, 7 here. Is that going to classify as a 7? in a data did. So let's actually get some random samples of other random samples. Normally in artificial intelligence or machine learning, they talk about cross-validation sets, and so you get your data set and you split it in half and you train it. No, no, so this, I've trained this on a random sample of 200 numbers here, so I'm gonna get a different random sample here of different data, and so we'll actually see, you know, I could get it completely different, take the complement, and so we get this other random sample here of 50 digits, and of course I want to actually classify it on the first of these things, so I'll just take the first of the RRs here, and that gives me the list of digits, and I'm just gonna apply the classification on it, MC, and actually see what I get back. So here, can it fit on screen? I see the 2, the 7, the 6, the 5. Oop, the 5 was a 4, the 9 was a 1, the 0, the 1, and so on. So okay, so I can see that. What I need to actually compare that now to this list of actually the last value of these things instead of the first, which I know to be the actual answers on this random set. Last, we can apply it here. And so here we get these two things, and I'm going to put thread over the top of this stuff, and there we go. So there's the pairings we can actually sort of see. So we can see indeed the 2s match, the 7s match, 6s, whoop, that didn't match there, the 4 and the 5 here didn't match, and you know 7 and 8 didn't match. And so we're getting reasonable matches. Let's actually now, we want to actually resolve this to equal, and so this is a replace, this is an apply at level 1. So if I make that F here, for instance, you can actually see I've made F, it replaces there, but if I make that equal, I can see which values were equal and which ones weren't. And so we can see some sort of falses there, and so I can actually get this particular thing. I can get this and count the number of falses here. And so this is my sample of 50. I've got 11 wrong. And so I can see that I've got around about 22% of the examples are wrong. So I've trained it with 200 examples here, and I've got some 22%. It's only accurate to 22%. So here, I'm going to actually classify it. And so strictly, I'd keep one subset and I'd divide it, and so they wouldn't actually appear to be the same. But I've got 70,000 digits, so there's going to be enough random overlap. So here, I've got this classifier a little bit better. Take a different random sample of 50 digits here, and actually now apply this, and actually take a look at the count, and I'm down to 3. So it only got 3 wrong out of that. So 3 out of 50, we're getting a bit better here in this particular sample here. And so... Oh, and I'm sort of really going over time now, I'll wrap this up kind of quickly. Here's, and we can actually see for after this classification here, we could actually take a look here and see the, right, we won't do that. I could take a look at this. This is an example here where the classification isn't quite so good. It doesn't break down. We see there's a lot of feature sets here. So this thing, if we actually take a look at our classifier, we can actually see that the number of classes, there's actually its feature type image. If we get the full information on that classifier information here on MC, we can actually see it's got, you know, it's using nearest neighbors right here. We could actually turn around and change that classifier to use the method of logistic regression or something else like that instead. And get other particular things, and get the classification information on that. And it should probably tell us the feature set. There's a way to actually get it out of there. Quite a bit over time. Right, okay, so the example here of the Titanic, and so the probabilities of dying and death. And that's kind of interesting, and graphs and all sorts of other stuff. But anyway, machine learning, it's a very active field. It's very interesting, and this allows you to do a bit of a taste of it. There's the other bits. I'll wrap it up there then. So, yes. Okay.